Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Well, we are doing another throwback episode today. This is episode number 7. At least I'm renaming it number 7 as I'm taking out some of the content that didn't fit or had to get moved elsewhere. And in this podcast today, you know, what I think is so fun about doing these podcasts as I look back at this one. This particular physician has a completely different viewpoint on life than I do. She is someone that is just so well connected, but yet really has some fascinating differences in terms of how she views healthcare and what I would call generally more left-leaning views, which is different than the kind of views that I personally hold. And so I think getting this diversity of opinions is so important in this world today. And so in this particular interview, you are going to learn about the path of this combined PhD-MD program and why she decided to just focus on one of those paths. You're also going to learn about her views on the waste of healthcare and the one system that she believes could save our healthcare system billions of dollars. With no further ado, here is the interview with Dr. Danielle Ofri.
My name is Dave Denniston, and welcome to my latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, I've been networking with other authors and experts who can speak to the issues that physicians face every single day. Just for example, what can we do to make primary care more attractive? And how can we lower the debt load that many medical students face? And that's why I thought I'd bring a special guest to the podcast, Dr. Danielle Ofri, MD, PhD. Dr. Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital, which is the oldest public hospital in our country. She writes about medicine and the doctor-patient connection regularly for the New York Times and other publications. Her lectures to medical and general audiences are renowned for her use of dramatic stories, and she happens to avoid PowerPoint while she's at it. And her writings have appeared everywhere, in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Lancet, and on CNN.com and NPR. Well, in addition to all of that, Danielle is the author of 4 books about the world of medicine: How Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine, Medicine and Translation, and more. And besides that, she also writes some essays, which have been selected by a variety of folks, Stephen Jay Gould, Oliver Sacks, and Susan Orlean, for the Best American Essays, as a matter of fact, twice, and even in Best American Science Writing. And she's received an award, the John P. McGovern Award from the American Writers Association, for preeminent contributions to medical communication. And even now, she is working on a new book about the doctor-patient communication. Well, still having several unfinished novels in various states of disrepair that are gathering the grimy New York City dust under her bed. She lives with a husband, 3 kids, her loyal lab mutt, and the forever challenges of the cello in an intimate Manhattan-sized apartment. Well, welcome, Dr. Ofri.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, tell us a bit about yourself. What inspired you? What's been your journey like to have been a physician?
Well, I come from a family of 100% teachers, educators, social workers, nobody in medicine or science. Mm. And I'm not quite sure how I got the medicine bug in my head. I think originally I wanted to be a vet because I had a dog and that was my goal. And somewhere along the line, it seemed to have morphed. And I think it's because in my local high school, if you like science, you were going to be a doctor. I had no idea what doctors did. I didn't know you could be a scientist. So I just went along that route. I ended up at at McGill University in Montreal, a little bit by happenstance. It had a very late application deadline. I was a little behind on applying. And I found myself enmeshed in a complete science program. It's a British-style school, and so I suddenly learned about the world of science and that real, you know, intellectuals go into science and only the technicians go into medicine. So I thought, oh, my gosh, I have to go into bench science. And then I found that I could do an MD-PhD program, which seemed to solve the problem. I'll do both, figure it out along the line. And so I did that, and I had a wonderful time here at NYU, and I thought I would go into neurology since I was doing neuroscience research. Mm-hmm. But I had to do a one-year internship, which I did at Bellevue, and then I just fell in love with general medicine and stayed. So that was kind of the path to clinical medicine. I didn't know what doctors did, but I loved doing it once I got there.
Isn't that something? And is this path going, getting the combination MD and PhD, is that additional, you know, usually there's three, 4 years of medical school. Is there additional schooling you had to do for that, or was it a longer residency, or what is that path?
Well, the medical school program, instead of 4 years, becomes 7 to 8 years. Usually you do the first 2 years of medical school and then go hibernate in the lab for 3 or 4 years, get your PhD, and then go back to the clinical rotations. And now all your classmates are your residents. In some cases, your attendings.
Program then going into residency after that, or are you?
And then you go to residency like anyone else. You're equally, you know, unqualified once you finish the MD PhD program to practice medicine. That you're now do a residency. So for me, it was a long haul.
Wow.
So by the time I, you know, got into actual practice, you know, I've been in school for a long time. I was really ready for. But I had expected I would be the typical MD-PhD route, is that you become a scientist who does 1 or 2 mornings a week in clinic, and mainly you do clinical trials and basic research. But I found that I really loved primary care. And also that I wasn't, you know, when I saw the world of research and the grant writing and the fierce sort of cycle of trying to fund yourself, it didn't appeal to me so much. Although I loved being in the lab and I loved the science behind it, I just didn't see myself enjoying the rat race of grant writing.
Yeah, because it's competitive, isn't it? I mean, you're having to compete and get money from large corporations in order to fund the grants a lot of the time.
All right, and often it's just, you know, NIH grants, but it's fiercely competitive. And for most people, they spend, you know, more time writing grants than actually doing research. And I think that seems to be the challenge, whereas the research itself is wonderful, but most people find that their time, energy is sapped by the grant writing, you know, forever treadmill. So, and I was thrilled to be doing medicine.
Good. You get to interact with the patients and get to do some other things and still do some of your research. I mean, obviously, you've been able to have other outlets here. And one of the ways I connected with you was by finding your blog. And I thought you had a great post on there that talks about the ethics of money in medicine. And I thought it was such a good post, and it was thought-provoking. You had said in the post, the duty to take care of patients is the foundation of medicine, and all other concerns emanate from this mandate. And you said this is a distinct from other industries in which the primary aim is to earn money. So tell us more about your bent on this and why you feel this way.
Well, as you mentioned, I work in a city clinic at Bellevue Hospital. It's a big city hospital in New York. And it's a safety net hospital. And one of the reasons I love working there is that the patients are wonderful and you do feel like you're doing something, you know, important. And you can start to see how money can get in the way. In the patient I cited in this article who was going to the pharmacy to get her medication, and suddenly her albuterol inhaler was $168. She either hadn't reached her copay or whatever the issue was, which was shocking. Albuterol has been around for 50 years. In most countries, it's over the counter or $7. And she really, you know, but she couldn't do it without. She had to not take her blood pressure pills, you know, that month because she really didn't have the money. And that kind of thing, you know, as a doctor, it's horrifying. That, and, of course, it's incredibly cost-ineffective because if it doesn't get her inhaler, she'll end up in the emergency room and generate $10,000 worth of bills on behalf of medication that probably costs, you know, $5 to make.
Right.
And we hear about, you know, cost cutting and savings, which of course I support. We should be, you know, streamlining our costs. But this type of thing, when it's on the backs of the patients and on the backs of their direct health, seems absurd and it also just seems immoral.
Well, I think it's a good point that if we're trying to save costs, right, that having someone run to the emergency room because they can't get the medicine that they want seems kind of counterintuitive.
And you may, people that remember George Bush's famous comment that anyone can get medical care, just go to the emergency room. But, of course, it's a terrible way to do it and terrible medically. And if you're just thinking about costs, it's absolutely terrible financially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that is so interesting to talk about is there can be this tension between hospital administrators and physicians. And for those running the hospital, you know, they're definitely thinking about cash flow. They're thinking about profit. What do you think? How does this compare to pharma or devices or other healthcare-related industries?
Well, you know, having not been in those industries, I can't speak absolutely, you know, with conviction. But, you know, medical device companies are there to make money. There's no bones about it. The pharmaceutical mm-hmm. industry is not there for our good wishes. It's there to make money. And their secondary aim is to provide the medicines that we need, but not as a charitable service. It's there to make money. So that is the first goal. In a hospital, it's a little bit different. We're, you know, technically nonprofit, though many, of course, nonprofit hospitals make quite a bit of money. So at the very least, our goals are different. So I think that does temper the administrators a bit. I think that those who choose to be hospital administrators still have a primary motivation for health care and not so much for money. Nevertheless, it can come in conflict, you know, with physicians. And sometimes, you know, a good example is some of these quality measures that hospitals are administrators very hyped up about. So a couple of years ago, when the guidelines for mammograms were relaxed, instead of every year, every 1 to 2 years, and there's some, you know, changing of the guidelines to not be as strict because the data for benefit, you know, it can be debatable. Nevertheless, the quality measures indicator is annual mammogram. So I remember we got an email saying, you know, although these new guidelines have come out, still remember to order the annual mammogram so our numbers, in essence, our numbers look good. So they're seeing it differently than we are. Of course, we'll be penalized or we'll look less like we're giving less quality care if we don't order mammograms annually. So there can be that conflict between administrators and physicians and that type of thing. Right out of residency, I did a summer stint in a family practice, and I remember sitting down at the desk, and there were just stacks of insurance forms for all the different insurance companies that patients had on my desk. A patient would need an eye exam, so I had to pull up their insurance, and how often does that insurance company reimburse an eye exam? And every paperwork, you know, is different for different companies. We had to have 3 administrators per 1 physician just to deal with the different insurance companies. So that's one way which things are incredibly wasteful financially, but also time-wise. I mean, is there any reason we couldn't have standardized forms, even for different health insurance companies? Why does it have to be reinventing the wheel for each company? It's not that different. I was just doing a prior authorization, you know, and every company has a different form. It could be standard. It's not that hard. You know, diagnosis, medication, reason, and make it online and make it a standard form. You know, we have standardized sizes for nuts and bolts for plumbing. Mm-hmm. I think we can do that for paperwork and medicine.
Streamlining would be awesome. Well, one of the things I think about, too, for many docs, I mean, like, take your case. I mean, it's a great example of here you spend all this time in education, and so in most cases, you're 10 years behind most of your peers before you start mm-hmm. making money. So the way the system is currently set up with residency, it seems like it couldn't really be palpable to change that unless residency and fellowship changed. And I just saw a pediatrician the other day in my office, and she's in residency, and she has over $300,000 in student debt. And, of course, in residency, you can't pay that back anytime real quick, right? I mean, you're making $50,000 a year. You know, most students and that residents in this case, you're paying 7% on $300,000 of debt. You know, that's $21,000 in interest. Mm-hmm. you can't live on $10,000 after taxes get taken out. So,
right.
And we talked about it in my book how there's a lot of debt reduction programs for docs, and it seems like for her, you know, she's thinking about going into fellowship, for example, but it's a losing proposition in terms of starting to make a dent in her debt or anything else. And she'll be making marginally more if she goes into fellowship and delaying that big income jump. So it really struck to me that if we want to attack costs and we want to change things up, that maybe one of the things that needs to be looked at in order to attract more residents and fellows into primary care, and I've been noodling this idea around and just gathering some people's thoughts, couldn't we maybe increase salaries in third year of residency for primary care docs, or maybe cut residency by a year so that way they're not as behind their peers, or maybe a year of medical school debt be covered by a commitment for the first 10 years of their career to primary care or something? What do you think? What are some of your thoughts on ways we
could? Well, it's interesting that when medical students, you know, attend medical school and residency, they pay the same tuition and, you know, come out with the same debt. Yet some physicians who go into subspecialties will make two or three times what people go into primary care. And somehow that seems intrinsically unfair. And I think we as a society can decide, you know, how do we, well, there's one thought of, should we regulate how many specialty physicians are available? You know, do here in Manhattan, you know, you just go down the block and triple or dozens of dermatologists and cardiologists, but it's always harder to find primary care doctors. And so one thought that people have floated around is regulating the number of residency slots based on what society needs and not what anyone wants to do. Now, I could see that would not be met with such great, feedback from doctors. I think people want to do what they want to do, but the reason we couldn't make certain fields more attractive. And clearly, the shortage is in primary care areas, and we have no shortage of subspecialists. And so forgiving a year or two of debt or some percentage of debt or of medical school, I think makes perfect sense. And that's how economists always, you know, adjust things we need in society. We give tax breaks or deductions for things we want people to do, like, for example, mortgages, and add taxes on things we want them to do less of. So I think that would be a wonderful idea. I think it would also ultimately be cost-effective if we had more primary care doctors, especially in underserved areas. Again, besides being morally the right thing to do, I think it would be a money saver for the healthcare system overall.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'd like to bring it full circle a little bit and talk about your books. Now, you've written quite a few, which is amazing that you found time to do all that. I think it's really, really cool. But what advice would you give to other docs who are considering writing books themselves or looking to get on the speaking circuit? What tools, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think it all depends on what your passion is. And I didn't plan to become a writer or a public speaker. As I said, I plan to go into research. And it only came about as I became interested in these topics and began writing about them. And I would highly recommend getting some writing training. I mean, you wouldn't do any medical procedure without being trained how to do it. And I think the same can be said for writing. No one wakes up and becomes James Joyce overnight. There's a lot of craft to learn. So I, for example, took a number of writing classes in the very beginning, both in groups and then one-on-one with writing teachers, and those were extremely valuable. It didn't make me the Nobel Prize-winning writer, but it improved my craft greatly, and it took what ability I had and refined it to the point where my writing became much better. So I really recommend that anyone who wants to write, you know, work with a writing teacher or a writing class to hone your skills. There's much that can be learned. And then it takes on a life of its own. So for me, I took off a year and a half after residency and to travel, and I did some locum tenens, some temp work for doctors, which was really a lot of fun. And that's when I began writing. And I wasn't writing in any idea of writing a book. I just wanted to write down some of the experiences that were so intense during residency. I trained during the height of the HIV epidemic, and it was a very intense time. There wasn't much time to think about the ramifications of what we were experiencing. So for me, those 18 months were time to write and think. And then I began taking writing classes, and at some point my teacher suggested I get an agent, and I began submitting the essays to literary journals, a great place to start, and some medical journals. My first piece was in JAMA. And that's a good way to start. And then you get invited to come speak, and that's, you know, grand rounds, and it's, you know, as you, the more you write, the more people invite you to come speak, and the more you're invited to write for other publications. And another thing is to, you know, be open to meeting people wherever you go. When people have questions, engage in conversation. You never know who you'll meet. You speak to a group of 30 people. One person may, you know, may work for a journal or work for an institution that then invites you. And so I answer every email that people send, even the ones that are negative. I always respond, you know, engage people. And, you know, each connection opens up another door. So to be really open to that, be sociable in that. And then, but also be true to who you are. I mean, when I first got an agent, she said, oh, we'll make you enough money so you can quit your day job. And I said, no, I don't want to quit my day job. I am a doctor. And that's first. I want to write about what I do, but I don't want to see writing as a way to earn a salary so I can quit medicine. I am a doctor. And, you know, a number of doctor commentators, you know, no longer see patients, and I don't want to be that. I want to be someone who's first and foremost a practicing physician so that my observations have some credibility, but that's also who I am. I want to stay true to my ideals. And so I will turn down, for example, I was invited a couple times to give interviews for commercial ventures, and I won't do it because for me, when I publish a paper, being able to say I have no conflicts to disclose is very important. So I work hard to preserve my independence, and that I'll never, I don't want anything I do tainted by any commercial connections.
Very good, very good. Well, what can we expect to see from you in the future? You mentioned, told me earlier you had a new book that you've been working on, as well as several others that are in various states of disrepair. What do you expect to see from yourself in the future?
Well, the novels are under the bed, and periodically I haul them out when I go on vacation and revisit them, and they tend to go back under there. But, you know, next time I get a sabbatical, I might work on that again. So the book I'm working on now is loosely titled What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. And that came about in researching what doctors feel. I had ended up interviewing a doctor who told me about a patient for whom she'd had a bit of a friendship outside of the office, which is a topic I was interested in. But I later interviewed the patient who gave a completely different story. And both doctor and patient were thoughtful, intelligent people, very, very ethical, but they saw the events that transpired between them completely differently. And had I not known, it could have been two different stories. And I was so fascinated by how that could be. And I think that it's a very common scenario, even with well-meaning doctors and patients, that doctors hear the story very differently than patients tell the story. And that this could, besides just not being good medicine, you can imagine how many errors could take place, misdiagnoses. And I think a lot of patient frustration is around that area of not being able to convey to the doctor what they really mean and what they need. And I think doctors, even well-meaning doctors, often miss the boat because they're not getting it. And so I've been curious about, you know, this area of doctor-patient communication. So that's what I'm working on. And I'm looking for other doctor-patient pairs to interview. So if any listeners are a doctor or a patient, and think their counterpart, doctor or patient, would be interested in talking to me, please email me. Contact me at my website, danielleofrey.com. And everyone is anonymous if they wish to be. And my goal is not to expose anyone or you know, show people's terrible errors, but to see how communication can go awry and how they can be improved upon.
Very good. Very, very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Ofrey. I look forward to reading your next post and your next book. If you are a physician wanting to tell your story or grappling with tough issues or have tools that you want to share with other docs, I would love to share it as well in the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Make sure to contact me at dave@daviddeniston.com or on my website, daviddeniston.com/physicians. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Thank you so much for joining us, and make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a good day.